Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
This week's theme is getting the people part right. This is really seems to be a vital root of how we operate in any workplace or community, any place where we interact with others. Our guest this week believes that one person alone in a conversation can act skillfully to shift the interaction so that all parties are drawing out the best in each other. She cites that the meaning of life is not what happens to people. The meaning is what happens between people. This week's question, what are some of the strategies and tools that have worked for you in drawing out the best in people and in communicating effectively? We have the pleasure of a remarkable moderator, Preeta. Preeta is an attorney, a graduate of Harvard Law School, has been a senior partner in law and investment firms. She is currently a lecturer at MIT Media Lab and a senior advisor at MIT's Laboratory for Social Machines. She has been a general counsel and senior policy advisor in the Obama White House Office of Management and Budget, where she met President Obama when they were both at Harvard Law School students there. And she's been the chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and is currently on President Obama's Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. She has currently stepped back from public life in Washington and is working on transformation within the service-based community. She works behind the scenes and is one of the pillars of the service-based community right now. So Preeta, would you care to share with us some of your thoughts about today's theme?
Well, thank you so much, Arye. It's really an incredible pleasure and privilege for me to be here in conversation with Jeannie. I've just been so blown away by both Jeannie as a person, as I've spoken with her, and also with her work. You know, it's funny, in my own life and my experience, getting the people part right is really all of the work that we have in front of us. And I think, you know, until I really started engaging more with Jeannie and learning about her work, you know, I realized that my toolbox has been kind of limited. I think for me, you know, trying to transform an interaction has usually involved deep listening. You know, trying to step back if I sense the interaction is maybe not going the way I would like, trying to say less and stepping back and just trying to listen more. And I think that strategy can be really effective if you're a manager, if you're the person, on one side of a power dynamic potentially. But I think what I've learned from Jeannie is when you're the target, when you're the person who's being perceived, when you're the lower status person in a relationship, the student or the employee, there's other really powerful tools that can really transform the interaction. And deep listening is one that is very effective when you're the manager, but, you know, sometimes you need something, you know, slightly different and a slightly different presence of being and, way of being to transform it when you're not the one, when you're supposed to be the one that's performing or putting something out there or saying something brilliant. So I'm just really excited to get to know Jeannie's approach, get to know her as a person who I think she embodies this. She's a scholar, she's a professor, she's an executive coach, she's a relationship builder, and above all, she's really a love warrior who's trying to impart and teach the attitude of love to all interactions, including workplace interactions. At the core, her work is about learning the skill of bringing love and transformative participation into every interaction, primarily in the workplace. She believes it's possible for a single participant in an interaction to adopt behavior and successfully alter the communication dynamic, even when interacting with someone stuck in another mode. She was inspired to explore the challenge and challenge the traditional paradigms of interaction and behavior, including the theory, a well-known theory of self-fulfilling prophecy. This is a theory which states that what a teacher or other higher status individual expects of me, for better or worse, will often define how I perform or behave in that interaction. The classic expression of that concept is known as the Pygmalion effect, named for George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion, which found popular expression in the Broadway hit My Fair Lady. And I love being able to reference this because my high school graduation speech was actually about the Pygmalion effect. So I was just so fascinated to come across Jeannie's research. In that play, just to kind of illustrate self-fulfilling prophecy, Eliza Doolittle explains to Mrs. Higgins, she says that the difference between a lady and a flower girl is not how she behaves, but how she is treated. I shall always be a common flower girl to Professor Higgins, because he always treats me like a common flower girl and always will. But I know that I shall always be a lady to Colonel Pickering, because he always treats me like a lady and always will. This theory, which is designed to explain the performance consequences of low expectations, views the low status target as just that, a target who's powerless to affect the power dynamic within relationships. This phenomenon, combined with confirmation bias, which is the concept that those in authority tend to see and hear people and ideas with whom they already agree, can lead to organizational stagnation and non-creativity, because those in power see what they expect to see, and what they expect to see, they actually help make happen through the effects of self-fulfilling prophecy. So Jeannie kind of uproots all of that. She was motivated to understand how a single person, especially the low-target person, can interrupt this negative cycle, and how that lower-status target doesn't have to be a passive recipient and can push the interaction beyond this negative catch-22. And what she finds, what she found in her research and what she coaches people on, is that the target can actually love the higher status perceiver into behaving his or her way out of their own belief consistency trap. And she calls this mode the receiving mode. It's one of receptivity, openness, and learning. It's one in which the target views every relationship before him and her as an opportunity to learn and to love, rather than to perform, do, or display. So it turns out that one person is sufficient to initiate an upgrade, and that person can always be me. Fundamentally, this is a life skill within reach of us all, relevant to improving our effectiveness in our professional as well as personal lives, and about turning transactions back into relationships. It's a skill that must be that can be learned if we are to achieve our full potential and help others do the same. So Jeannie's approach is scientific, it's innovative, and it's counterintuitive, and it achieved breakthrough results with senior executives in major corporations on 6 continents. Dr. Kawaji holds multiple degrees from Stanford University, a PhD in organizational behavior and a PhD minor in social psychology, an MBA and an MS in engineering economic systems with a concentration in decision science. And she also has a bachelor's in systems engineering from the University of Virginia. So, an amazing person we have. I'm very excited to have this conversation with. So welcome, Jeannie.
Thank you, Frida. Wow, what an introduction. I think that you are embodying the entire message right now, both in content and in how you're being when you're talking about the content. You got that so right and complete.
Well, I would love to hear, there's so much we could talk about how you approach interactions, how you teach about them, but I'd love to just start with your story, your foundational story. How did you get interested in exploring kind of interpersonal interactions? And how did you, did the power of the human interaction discover you, or did you discover it?
Mentioned this before. Yeah. I have been told, in fact, I've been given the answer to that question, that people have been iterating to me over the course of many decades that this problem found you. And I think I was running away from the problem and it caught up to me. And finally, kicking and screaming, I ended up asking. It fueled a deep curiosity in me when I was looking around. I grew up in a wonderful family with Lebanese origins, and both of my grandparents came from a European or a Middle Eastern country. My mother's side from Romania, my father's from Lebanon, and I have siblings that are very close in age to me. And because we had so many people in the same age group, and I was actually the youngest of three, that there developed in our family a real In fact, my mother used to stagger our naps so that she could make sure that we each got our attention that we needed. And so I guess I grew up in a democracy, or in a place that democratized opportunity. So I never had in my mind that I wasn't able to, you know, have my own opinion even. So I guess even my grandfather, I noticed how whenever he walked into a room, everything just seemed more important. And he wasn't doing all the things that we are typically taught on how to, gain a person's goodwill. He would tell you exactly what he thought, you know, and he wouldn't waste your time, and you would like him more. So he was, somehow, I was faced in my family and upbringing with behaviors that seemed extremely effective, and yet they didn't have any of the trappings of what we normally would consider even political correctness or trying to convince other people. So something as simple as, I would like this, will you give it to me, is far superior than, let me give you all the reasons why you should want to give this to me. And so I guess I grew up with a dichotomy, you know, a contrast effect, and that developed in me, I think, a real curiosity of paying attention and observing what's going on in the world and what's really truly effective. And how I started was just started to take notes. I took notes on just observing other people and saying, wow, that really made me feel good, or this really didn't make me feel good. And so I guess I was just a journalist, really, collecting all kinds of data and then ultimately practicing it and testing it out and finding out for myself how powerful it was to adopt almost an opposite approach to what we often think of as a tactical strategy for trying to change others. And so I grew up in Maryland and spent all of my growing up years there near Washington, D.C., and went to the University of Virginia, and then studied systems engineering there and got very interested in what I, by accident, found called decision science. And I was drawn to medical decision making. And if we didn't get the medical decision making right, really dire consequences could follow. And so I wrote my undergraduate thesis on medical diagnostic decision making. And that spawned me on to come to Stanford. I applied to one graduate program and one faculty member I wanted to work with named Ron Howard. And I wrote in my, I guess, essay that said, and I want to work with Ron Howard. He wasn't even taking master's students as advisees, but lo and behold, I ended up as his advisee. And, you know, that biblical statement, ask and you shall receive, is quite powerful. And you better be careful what you ask for with your heart. And I think the universe will align itself to really give it to you and give you more than what you actually even expected. Does that answer your question?
So how did your focus, you said you kind of became a bit of a journalist, monitoring what behaviors were effective and made you feel good and which ones weren't. What did you find? Like, what did you find was the magic of what was working and what wasn't?
Well, you know, at the
kind of
time
before you got into the research of it, but just kind of from the lay observation.
Well, you know, that is a very good question, because I think sometimes you learn this particular way of being, not actually cognitively, but just by behaving it and even not even realizing what you're behaving. So I remember when I was 17, I worked at this family theme park called Wild World, and one of my colleagues there was a friend of my brother's who I had known for about 10 years. His name was Steve, and he came up to me one day and said, you know, I've been observing you for 10 years. I said, oh, really? And he goes, whenever we're in a situation, you seem to get things that aren't even on the menu, and the people are telling you, they seem happier to give it to you than you even, as the recipient, are. And I've seen you do this routinely. And as he was trying to explain this phenomenon that he had been observing of me, I was eating French fries, and I had wanted ketchup, and I was so tired, and it was so far away at this big cafeteria. And he goes, wait a minute, let me run and get you ketchup. So he runs all the way to the opposite corner and comes back, and then he notices. He goes, you did it to me. You did it to me again. And so they were making claims that I was doing things, like a magician that didn't know she was a magician, right? And I also think that growing up with my wonderful siblings, I always felt, even though I was the youngest one, I was the middle child of four. I think structurally I should have been overlooked, right? If you're a middle child, you're not the oldest or the youngest. So you don't necessarily gain structural advantage just because you're in a lucky situation. So it turns out that the methods that you need to use, because you're in this predicament, are very different than the tactical manipulative approaches. They have to be genuine and they have to be receiving oriented, really. So that when, you know, we had this rule in our family that when you have a piece of cake and one person cuts the cake and the other person gets to pick which piece they want, right? So I remember being startled that, you know, I would cut the cake and my sister would pick the smaller piece. So I had all of these examples falling in my lap of how things weren't supposed to work. And I was always involved in that situation, right? So I guess that's, so Steve, this guy from this summer program, he looked at me very sternly and said, you have got to figure out what you're doing and to articulate it for the world because I want to know what it is you're doing. And that one comment was probably in the back of my head, and I was always kind of in pursuit of that. And that's when I really started taking notes because Steve wanted it, right? And so even the birth of receiving theory was invited by a receptive interaction.
That just wow, fueled. That's beautiful.
So that's one of many.
Yeah. So in So in that ketchup story, when Steve went across the cafeteria and got the ketchup for you, do you have any sense, like looking back, what you were maybe doing that led him to do that? Was it verbal? Was it nonverbal? Like what was going on?
Well, a couple of things that I think that I was doing, I was being very clear with what I wanted, right? So I must have told him that I would enjoy the, you know, I would enjoy these French fries so much more if there were ketchup here. But I didn't share it with him with any kind of expectation or force or agenda for him to have to go and get it for me. I was almost offering it as, oh, here's what my situation has enlightened me to my desires. Let me share them with you. Maybe you can help me. Maybe he could help me get enough energy for myself to get over there and get the ketchup. So I didn't have a rigid prediction on who was supposed to do what. And that is parlayed into a definition of receiving theory, is share with people what you truly want, but not in a forcing way. So I could almost invitationally help invite him to help solve my problem, but not forcing him to do it, not even forcing him to do it, and not forcing him to play any role or any particular role in it. So you know what reminds me? I used to use one of the earlier Macintoshes and when I was even writing my dissertation, and it would crash on me almost every day, and then it would show a box would come up. You shut down your computer wrong. You should not do that ever again. And then it had one button, and that button was okay. And it flexed because it called itself a dialogue box. Right?
I can relate to that.
And so I think we're having a lot of monologues that we are pretending are dialogues. And, you know, I'm asking questions. Even in the debate, the vice presidential debate, I was marveling at the fact that, and I liked both candidates very much, but Tim Kaine was making statements and then saying, now why isn't Mike Pence answering these questions? And I was saying to myself in my living room, because they're not questions. Tim, they're not questions, they're just statements. And so I see the subtleties now in what's really, I can say something like, do you have any questions, and really communicate, you better not have any questions for me. Or I could say something like, do you have any questions? And you might not see a difference if at the visual level, because it's almost identical words. But there's this space underneath our actions that I call the intentional space. And it's like wind or gravity, and I'm in control over whether I am inviting you, right? I'm having the wind come from you to me in terms of an invitation, or I'm trying to push you away with a gust of wind, right? And in one case, when I'm saying, you don't have any questions, do you? If people have questions, they won't ask them because I'm not ready to receive them. And if I say, but what questions do you have? But one time I asked, what's the vision of your company? And a guy in the back stood up and said, we don't have one, but it looks like you want one, so can you give us a couple minutes? And so these are lots of examples that were peppered through my consulting career and growing up and jobs and friends. And I was always observing that there were two states of being, one that was effective and one that was ineffective. And I came to this conclusion that we didn't know we had complete control over this. Mm-hmm. And so I started to figure out if I could just uncover over time, when I was being most effective, I noticed that the other person was delighted and so was I. And when I was being ineffective, I was really frustrated, but so was the other person. So I've developed and then gotten to test notions that, you know, if you win, I win, and if you lose, I lose. And then I grew up with a very Catholic and religious upbringing. And so even now when I study, like, Luke's gospel, which I think Luke was a psychologist back in the day before psychology was even invented, and you see different stories that were told in that tradition that speak out loud to me that, oh, he's just telling us to be receptive, to have a receptive heart. It's not what we're doing, it's how we're being. And so I was able to, with the help of a lot of wonderful advisors and students and participants in my classes, I would share these notions. I'd share how I developed them in the laboratory, and then I'd convert them into an application they could try, and I'd beg them, will you try it out and get back to me? And I was flooded mm-hmm. with emails that would say things like, I've been working on this problem for 20 years, and this worked like magic and instantaneously. And so I got fueled by the feedback that people were so generous to give to me over the years.
Wow. So let's take that, like, your work is around kind of low target or low status individuals. Let's say, you're somebody, let's say you're working for an auto dealership, just to come up with a random example. You have an idea that they should be, I'm the worker. I have this idea that we should be expanding to a new market. My boss consistently has rejected this, has not been open to my idea, doesn't think much of my contributions on the kind of creative side, just kind of wants me to just do what they tell me to do, what he tells me to do. So I'm having an interaction with him, and, it's kind of based on past interactions, it's a little dismissive on his part in terms of asking my ideas, but I really want to try and shift that dynamic.
Right.
How would that work?
So you're either in one, you have a focus. So if I'm the employee, right, going to my boss, I have this focus. I am focused on my boss changing. He has to change. He has to, and I'm judging, and I don't even realize this, but I'm judging. And it turns out I can't be judging and receiving at the same time. I'm one or the other. There's a wonderful quote by a retired guy at Greenleaf from Harvard, and he says, there is no middle ground between arrogance, which I believe is wanting to change other people, and humility, which is wanting to be changed. And so when I approach this, my boss, instead of throwing my suggestion at him, so I'm going to play a game of throw at, right? I'm going to offer it as a gift. And you know when you offer a gift, you are curious to know what the recipient thinks of it. I mean, I can hardly wait. Tell me if you liked it. Tell me what you didn't like about it. And so, so it's the manner in which I'm either offering or throwing at that's going to shift. And I can decide if I'm going to have my throwing, hand ready or my catching glove ready before I even walk into the door.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what's so mm-hmm. surprising is that I was working in an investment bank in London, and I remember this vividly. I was approached this guy who failed to comply with what I had told him to do. He wasn't my direct subordinate, but he ran the whole computer systems, and in order for my program to be implemented in the investment bank, his team had to perform. And so I start telling him what he didn't do and why he should do it, right? And the days when smoking was allowed, and he was smoking a cigarette, and he started blowing more and more smoke in my face, and I was literally suffocating, right? And the more I and I had just finished business school, and I was employing all of those negotiation tactics, you know, that we typically use that my brain actually thinks should work. And the result, and he was giving me a very big gift. He was giving me correct feedback. So even though my brain was making logical, rational, brilliant, killer arguments, I was really just killing myself when I was doing this. So all of a sudden, I vividly recall, as I was choking, okay, so I got to the end of my unraveled rope. And I just looked up in a very non sequitur way. I looked at him and said, am I really yelling at you? And he goes, well, yes, you are. And I said, well, that surprises me. Does that surprise you? And he goes, no. And I'm like, how come? I want to know. He goes, well, you've been hanging out with all those traders over there. And the traders I was working with are lovely people and very different people outside the trading desk. But I was actually becoming like that, what I was hanging around and what the norms had become. So immediately, once I shifted to that, it was an instant shift. He then gave me a VIP tour of the bank, and he himself delivered all of the computer systems before he went home that evening. So I was marveling at this, and this was right after my MBA and right before I entered the doctoral program. It was the summer in between. And I know that story really influenced me when I was seeking a solution to this negative self-fulfilling prophecy effect, because I saw really brilliant ideas and brilliant people being prematurely dismissed. And it's like an opportunity cost problem in economics, that we would prematurely dismiss, you know, somebody's idea, or we would we'd prevent them from even offering it. And we will never be able to learn what we missed. So it was a problem that was really hard to get correct feedback on. And the only
person
aware of it is the person who got, you know, dismissed. They're the only people in the know. So that's why I started with that as being the solution area. That's the only person who's in the know of a great value that leaked out.
Wow. So I just want to get that story right. It's kind of fascinating. So you're talking to this person in London who's literally blowing smoke in your face.
Literally,
causing you to suffocate.
Yeah.
And in the middle of that, you're able to say, wait a minute, I'm not being very effective with you, am I?
Right. And
is that right?
That is exactly right. But I really had to be
able to. So you shift into receiving mode when someone is, like, physically assaulting you in smoke.
Yeah. Well, you enter into what I call crisis mode. And when you're in a crisis mode, you are just, help me, man, help me. And, you know, the person who can help us the most is the person that is offending us the most. You know, and I think I actually learned this from the feedback of, I was teaching a course in New Orleans to some really, some senior oil executives, and I was teaching with my colleague, and at the end, it was an unusual situation because I taught a 3-day class, and then with the same group of people, I was going to teach a 2-day class later that week, and we typically have evaluations at the end of each course. So I got an evaluation, and it was remarkable because things are so clear to me. I don't know if I'm just so blind, but most of these signals that come from the universe to me are so clear. So here was the clear signal. I got all 5s from people, except I got 1-1 on the evaluation of this, right? And this guy who gave me the 1 was going to be in my next class, right? So I was devastated, you know. I still have a difficulty with how we evaluate classes and how we create them into judgments and instead of learning arenas. But I was jogging through the streets of New Orleans, and it was raining even. And my lovely colleague, Leo, he is trying to consult, because he was there, and he knew whether I did a good job or not, right? But I was still disappointed, and he looked at me, and he said, Jeannie, I have a problem with how you're just perseverating over this. You have this information. You're going to see him tomorrow. You go up to him directly and ask him about it so you really understand why he gave you this one and what he's thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had to have one other person invite me to do that. And that's what receiving really is we give people correct feedback, and that fuels them. Well, it turns out this guy didn't understand something. And he claimed, he was trying to rationalize why he didn't understand it. He blamed it all on me. And I then said, well, that's great to know. And it turned out he was incorrect about what I had said and how I was doing. But this is what I found out in the world, is that we look around, who can take the blame? And we usually look for a very smart woman to do that. So It's very common, this gender bias, this gender problem, and that became a whole new area of my research and application of this. But and that deserves probably its own call or own book, encyclopedia. But so I did, and I was able to get around what he was judging, and I converted that judgment into what is it that he truly wanted. I explained it to him again personally, and then he changes my grade to a 6. Right?
Wow.
Here I am.
Wow.
So the people who are criticizing us, they are our teachers. And so I just learned, really for the first time, and I couldn't have learned this unless I did it with my own feet, but what prompted me to do it with my own feet for the first time was my colleague on the street. And he really reprimanded me. He said he had a problem with me. And I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't even think of it.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
But that's all.
Yeah, okay. So I'm just going to ask you, like, what do you do in a situation, like, let's say you're in a workplace situation where, you know, there actually is insidious bias involved. I'm African-American, and I have a boss who just thinks no matter what I put forward is not worthy of, you know, serious attention.
Yeah.
How do I put on, you know, as you said, the catcher's mitt there? How do I shift that? How do I target?
Yeah. You know, I remember when I was...
How do I get heard?
Here's the thing. It's almost, however my brain thinks I would get heard, do the opposite of it, and it'll be more right, okay? So I remember I was overlooked for a job, a consulting position, and it was a very clear situation. I was available, okay, as a consultant. I had just come off of another project, and there was a wonderful portfolio decision theory project in Mexico. And the head partner decided to take this guy named Jim off of a case that he was in the middle of and put him on his thing, overlooking me, right? And I had already even submitted my interest. So here I was kind of rejected. I don't know if this is a similar situation or not. Just rejected from, even worse than my opinion not being heard, my whole body wasn't picked as capable of doing this project. So I went to him in an inquiring mode, because here's what I wanted. I wanted to shift to what I really wanted. And I really wanted to be prepared to be a viable candidate in a similar situation in the future. So I went directly to him, and I said, I asked him, from my heart, I said, can you help me understand why you picked Jim over me? And I said, because, you know, I'm available, and he's not. And I said, was it because... you know, he speaks Spanish, because actually he didn't and I did. And then I said to him, I bet it's because you've worked with him before. And he hadn't worked with either of us. And then I said, I know, because he's probably done a lot of these portfolio projects, a specific kind of project analysis before. And it turned out I had and he hadn't. So here I am offering him information that he was unaware of and probably, if he had been told in a different way, would have just rationalized away. That afternoon, I was put on the project, to my great surprise. And I'm very grateful to him. So I wasn't angry at him for being biased against me, even if he had been biased. I went to him because I wanted to learn from him. I wanted to learn from his bias. So I had to love him and his bias and the injustice, or else I was going to leave value on the table and realize. You know, it reminds me when I was TAing a negotiation class at the business school at Stanford, and I was marveling at a negotiation exercise in which students then were willing to take a lower outcome for the very reason that it hurt their partner also. And I thought that was crazy. I said, you know, the objective of this negotiation is for you to maximize your points. And I see you've made a decision that doesn't do that. Why? And I really think that... we feel like we need to have a transactional bad outcome that we give to a erring other person, you know, somebody who's biased against us. They really need our help. They don't need our judgment. And you know, now that
I'm pondering your words. We need to learn from. I needed to learn from his bias, learn from his injustice.
Yeah. And really consider that to be a large gift. So my eyesight is changing. One of my clients in Geneva, Switzerland, said, you're retraining people's eyes, you know? So I want to catch what people are I want to catch everything as help, like Aikido, actually. Aikido is a martial art that it doesn't matter the intentions that somebody is moving toward you. I can always catch it as helpful energy that I get to develop a skill in redirecting and using that energy in the direction of what I want. In the direction of my wants. You know, you remind me of another very pivotal story that happened in my early childhood, and this might have been what triggered a lot of this shifting. When I was in junior high school, a person I knew ended up getting pregnant. And it was a shock, and it was so sad. And she had the baby, and I believe had great difficulty with her family. But I remember my across-the-street neighbor came, and she was our Girl Scout leader. She made one statement. She said, you know, this girl needs our support and our encouragement and our help. She does not need our judgment. So that, even that came from another source external to me, just in front of me on my street. And that really, I pondered that for a very, very long time. So I think it's similar to this, that the person who we could judge and get away with judging, and in anybody's court of law, I'd be found not guilty, right? Judging this? Judging the person who is biased against me or holds resentment toward me for an incorrect reason. But in my court of law, I would be found guilty, not them. My judgment is of their judgment is worse. I tell my husband sometimes when men typically think when you give them suggestions that you're judging them, and I go, you're really upset about your judgment of my judging you. Your judgment of my judgment, my judgment that's bothering you. It's your own. And so I think that's more amazing. True. And I'm so delighted to be among the scholars and the people, just curious people in the world that have the privilege of really thinking deeply about these issues, and more so having people allow me to talk with them about it, you know. That's a great delight.
So I'm fascinated. I mean, your theory, your practice, all of this sounds brilliant and exactly right. I'm curious, how do you coach or teach this in others? Because I'm struck by what you said at the start of the call, that you grew up, I think what you said was a place that grew up in an environment, a family that democratized opportunity. So you were taught from or demonstrated very early on that your opinion mattered, that your views mattered. When you grow up in a different environment where maybe you haven't had that sense of being, how do you open that up, open those channels up in people? How do you do that through your coaching and teaching?
Well, you know, that is such a good question. And I also have that question very often because each person is a little bit different. And in fact, I had the pleasure of talking with one of my longtime and long ago clients from a tech company here. And I asked her that question yesterday. I said, how do you think you learned this? What happened? And I have my notes that I actually took from that conversation yesterday. And here's the idea that she told me, that she presented, I guess she felt comfortable talking with me first about her hardest problems, right? And I think initially I have to demonstrate to people that I'm interested in helping them and not judging. And that then enables them to share with me their real struggles. And when somebody comes and says, I really care so much about fixing this situation. Here's the other thing that I know that I'm doing my job when people say, you need to come to my house for dinner, a client, right? Because you have to meet my children. They have to meet you. And I had the daughter of one of my Australian clients here with her husband for lunch. And she reminded me that the very first day of your lecture with my dad, he went up to you and said, you're coming over my house for dinner tonight. And then he corralled all of his children who didn't even live at home and said, you guys are coming here. You have to have a conversation. So there's something of authenticity. And I often think of it as I have to be receptive. And that is what allows them to be unafraid and then to present a real challenge that they have. And that's what happened yesterday in front of me, that the daughter of my client said, would it be okay if I told you about this situation I have with my, in her case, brother-in-law? I really want to fix it. And they almost see that this approach has a chance of working, whereas the many other approaches that they have tried have not given them the happiness and joy that they so want. And I think once you do it first, and then you keep doing it and you keep doing it and keep doing it, it becomes almost like an addiction. Or good grammar. You can't use bad grammar of interaction anymore when you know internally what it feels like to be in an effective interaction, that it just doesn't make sense not to be in one. I had a roommate in graduate school who was a gourmet cook, and she would say to me, there's absolutely no reason for food not to taste delicious. No reason. And I then decided to think about interactions, and I said, you know, there's absolutely no reason for interactions not to be effective. None. And so I had a very high goal. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, beautifully. Can you, I guess just thinking, you know, do you have any kind of examples of aha moments or shifts that you've witnessed over the years and kind of, you know, coaching people in receiving theory?
Well,
or have you?
I love lawyers, and I got the chance to work with the general counsel of one of the tech companies here, and he wasn't particularly even spiritual or religious. And I remember I would call him a couple months after we had finished our work together, and I asked him, I said, hey, so how are your C-suite people doing, your peers? And he says to me, Jeannie, they are being particular jerks, but that just means I get to love them more. And that kind of surprised me. I'm like, hey, I'm going to use that. That's amazing. So what has often been an aha for me is somebody using something, you know, that they somehow attribute to me, but it was really our co-created conversation. They go out, do it. They are aha, right? Really, really surprised. They come back and tell me about it, and that then surprises me. So there was another story that came up yesterday. I was at the Amtrak station in Philadelphia, traveling from Philadelphia back to Washington, D.C., and many, many years ago, and there was a woman, and you know that beautiful Philadelphia train station, Amtrak station, it's in a couple movies, I think.
Oh, yeah.
There was a woman and a man. I was sitting down waiting for my train, and there's a couple, a British couple, and they were complaining, and I'm like, wow. And I guess I'd grown up with a sensitivity to being aware of the needs of others. In fact, I remember this prayer that got instilled in me, and I say it every day. It's, you know, please make me ever mindful of the needs of others. I just, and that's sort of the rote prayer that ends every prayer, right? And I know I learned this from my parents or my mother especially. And so I guess I grew up with that awareness. So I went up to them and said, hey, can I help you? And they said, it's my husband. I gave him the portfolio, and he left it with our passports and our credit cards and money, and he left it in the taxi. And I said, he always leaves it. And I look at her, and here's the interesting part. I inject a little humor. I said, really? You knew that? You knew that he always loses it? Then why the heck did you give it to him? Right? And she goes, well, that's history. So I looked, she says, well, nobody's going to return it. I said, well, you know, if I got into the cab next and I found it, I would give it to the taxi driver. And I nudged the woman next to me. I said, hey, what would you do? And she said, oh, no, I would hand it to the taxi driver. So I looked at her and said, there are two people out of the billions of people on this planet who would actually give it to the taxi driver. So I call into question your hypothesis. So given that there's a possibility that you'll get it back, you have to play your role or else you're not going to get it back because of you. And I said, stand right here, right kind of in the central, and have your eyes fixed on the door that he would come in with, right? And he was going to be waving, if he comes in waving your portfolio and you are not there ready to catch it, then the reason you're not getting it is because of you. I said, I'm working on this theory of receiving, so I just thought you could try it out for me and see if it worked. Because you really don't have anything to lose. And then I said, here's my number if you need anything when you get to the area. Do you need any money? They had another credit card. Just give me a call. Well, I take an earlier train, and then I arrive at my parents' house in Bowie, Maryland. And a couple hours later, there's a phone call that comes to the house. My dad, and I'm taking a little nap, my dad answers it, gives me the phone, and says, there's this British woman on the phone, and she's saying, put me in your class, put me in your books. I did exactly what you said. I looked, and it was like an angel coming through, and the door is opened, and a flood of light comes in, and there's that taxi cab driver waving my portfolio, just as you said. And that was really surprising to me, because I didn't realize it was going to happen in that way. And, you know, a similar thing happened to me. My purse was stolen on the train in Geneva, and I actually talked the thief into giving it back to me using this approach. To the great dismay.
Sorry, you talked.
Yeah. What was that?
Sorry, repeat that again. Sorry, you talked to him into giving it back to you?
My purse was stolen, as I was taking the train, embarking on the train at the Geneva airport, heading to Lausanne, Switzerland, at Lausanne, about an hour away. And as soon as I got on the train, you know, a guy, how they steal your purse on trains is they have a, one guy says, let me help you with your luggage, the other one steals your purse while he's nudging you. Well, I nudged him back, which is part of receiving theory, is you give people correct feedback. And I nudged him enough so that he ended up remaining on the train instead of exiting the train before it took off, both he and his partner off the train with the purse. So there I was, standing next to the guy who I thought had stolen my purse, right? And so I looked at the door, and I just kept saying, this is what I want. Here's what I want. Here, you know, you could, I don't need this, but I really truly want this. And here's the theory of receiving, is that people want to give to those who are ready to catch. People give to those who want. And so I was explaining in great detail what it was that I wanted, even to the extent that
To this man.
Even where to leave my purse. And he did exactly what I said. A thief. So this represented to me the real power, and that was an aha moment for me. The real power. I could actually be using this approach on everybody.
Great. That's so brilliant. Let me just ask you, I mean, you know, given the contentiousness of, you know, this year's political cycle, what would be your advice to you know, kind of the incoming leaders about how to receive those Americans who seem to violently oppose them?
You know, here's a notion that I often think of, is that we must be inclusive all the time. And so it's almost, here's the sort of the thing, is that it's my relationship as an elected official to the people I'm representing, not their relationship to me. So the first thing that I would ask, I think would be very helpful, is if people could focus instead on how they are learning from or being affected by everyone, right? Instead of worrying that other people like them or find them likable enough. And that puts me in a whole different world. I'm either in the receptive space or I'm in the judgmental space. And judgment often can look like niceness. And I think we fall into that trap very much. So there are ways that we are excluding people when we really don't realize it. And here is, you know, if you're a teacher and if you're a student in a class and the teacher kind of dismisses somebody's question, that actually affects me as his fellow classmate. I'm not going to ask a question then because I might be treated just like that person is. So what we really don't realize is if I, as a political leader, am communicating in a way that feels like I'm excluding even just one person, it's affecting everybody adversely. And so ways that you can develop this on your cabinet is that when I speak with somebody, I don't want them to tell me things they agree with me on. I want them to tell me things they don't agree with me on. And I want to make sure that I put in my advisory cabinet even people who are different, especially different from me, so that they can advise me and they can help me see things that I couldn't see without their help. And I know I was very, I felt good when Obama asked Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State. I mean, this was his formal rival, and he was inviting her to be on his cabinet. And I know that they were in the same political party and there were reasons for it, but I could also envision another scenario that I wouldn't want to put somebody who, you know, I wasn't so contentious with on my, and it gets back to that earlier thought we were saying, go to the person who gave me the low rating and really ask for his help. Ask for his help. How can I be better, right? How can you help me understand your perspective? And then you engage in what I call working the solution, or really finding solutions to problems instead of just what I call working the problem, coming up with rationalizations and proofs, which don't advance anyone. And they actually kill human spirits. So those are some of the things that come to my mind. It's how I'm being. Do you know, I don't know if you watch, there's a new show on TV. It's called Designated Survivor with Kiefer Sutherland in it.
Right.
And just in last week's episode, so it was aired Wednesday night at 10 o'clock, I think it's the third episode, and there's a speechwriter who has now been asked to fill in as the press secretary. And he starts his speech with, okay, you guys, I'm going to make mistakes. And I really would like you as the press to help me. And just my goal is that, we just do the best we can every single day. And this is really an impossible job. So how can you guys help me? and I get this feeling that he's going to change the relationship of the press. The press aren't going to be critical anymore. They're going to be helpful, just with that one very small initial statement of a minute and a half.
Right.
So that's another idea. But people can smell, people can accurately tell if I am receptive to them or if I'm judging them. And, I like to say even a dog knows that you're afraid of it, even though you're saying, nice dog, nice dog.
Mm-hmm.
So we're communicating this all the time. We're communicating whether we're approaching somebody wanting to help and be helped or whether we are approaching somebody wanting to judge and be judged. So I'm either exchanging help or judgment. And only one person has to go first. And help trumps judgment.
Help trumps judgment, wow. So do you have any kind of, to maintain this openness to keep learning from anybody, and as you said, especially to learn from those who are biased or bear injustice against you?
Yes.
Do you have a set, and you talked about Aikido, do you have a set of practices that allows you to be in this mode where you can catch whatever they send and redirect the energy in the direction you want? I mean, that's a real skill.
What a brilliant question. This is, by the way, this is all we have to get to. We don't even have to know the theory or the gravity between people or the self-fulfilling prophecy effect. Here's what I do. I have a bunch of, I call them mantras, right? And I hear, and I offer them, and some people offer them to me, and I keep a little list. And here are some of them. Find something to like and like it. Find something to learn and learn it. Respect all others. No exceptions. And I define respect as my attempting to understand them. No exceptions. And when I'm in a very, very difficult situation and I think this person is not deserving of my respect, I just in my head say, my rule, I already decided this, right? It's a decision I already made to respect him, to respect you, no exceptions. And I hold myself to that. And then once I'm there, just for a couple minutes, the magic happens and I shift and my eyesight changes. And I don't ever want to leave a situation until I like that person more. And that means I tell my feet, stay where you are, find something else to learn or like or comment on or offer, And I tell my feet not to move.
Wow.
Until I do. And that has worked for me so many times.
Mm-hmm.
There's a funny story on an airplane. I just finished teaching this, and I often teach this so that my goal is to hold myself to being in the state, and that's my ultimate goal. So when I teach it to people, I say, so I'm teaching it to you so you can catch me and help me get back in the state when I fall off, okay? And I just finished teaching this, and I was sitting on the airplane. I was going to Lebanon for the first time, and our plane had been delayed by a couple of hours, and there was some turmoil going on, and flights got rearranged, but I ended up sitting in a seat in a next to the only non-Lebanese person on the flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how unlucky am I, first time going to my country, where my roots are. And so I looked at the guy, and I said, oh, I got to find out what to like it or learn something about him. So I said, well, okay, better do it. And I forced myself to do this. It turns out I was, and I noticed my bias. And this is the real challenge, is that I am biased. You mentioned in an organization that has biases. Every organization has biases if they have a human being in there, just one, right? And there's the biases I don't even know that I have, and it distorts how I make sense of stuff. So when I was asking this guy who I didn't like yet, what is he? He says he's a singer. I said, oh, opera? He goes, no, more like Frank Sinatra. And I was judging him. Oh, he thinks he's like Frank Sinatra, And then I said, oh, he goes, he did a concert last night. And I said, oh, how many people did you have? 5,000. He goes, 50,000. I said, 5,000? Like, he said 50,000, and I heard 5,000 because I was harboring judgment eyes, and my judgment eyes distort what I actually hear. So my perception is not clear unless I'm in this receiving state. So I still don't like him. And then I notice all these kids are walking up and down the aisle, little people, tall people, and they're looking at him. And he says he's a singer. And I said, I just saw this show on Celine Dion, and she has a couple managers. You should get some managers. He said three of them are sitting in the back of the plane, and the other five couldn't get on the plane. It turned out something I didn't know was that his plane had gotten grounded. He took the last seat available, and we were flying in the last row of business class. And he had his entourage somewhere else. So he didn't look like he was Kazim Al Sahir, the most famous Middle Eastern speaker.
Wow.
Singer, I mean. His trappings looked very different. Mm-hmm. And so we're so quick to judge, even after I just finished teaching a class on how not to be judging. But what I ended up doing was it was inserting my own protocol. Don't stop until you find something to learn and learn it. And see, I could have left that plane not even realizing I was sitting next to him. I asked him if we could take a picture, and then when I went to my Lebanese friends and family, I said, guess who I sat next to? And I said, Kazim Al Sahir. And they said, you did not. I said, see, look at this picture. But see, that's kind of a nice story I try to remind myself of, that I'm missing, there's gold in front of me, and my job is to see it.
Interesting.
As I've been listening to this conversation, I've got a couple of questions. One is, I don't know if you've said this, but I'm curious about using this approach with young children in schools. Have you had this experience or trained teachers, or how does it work with young kids?
What a beautiful question, REA. That is the goal. You know, when I was teaching to the top 200 people at an oil company, they said, we're only paying you to pay the bills, but you really have to teach this to second graders worldwide. And so I have developed a practice in helping little elementary school kids love their bullies. So it's basically trying to cure the bully problem. And I have this wonderful voicemail that I've saved from my little niece, who was in second grade at the time, and a bully comes up to her, right, and says, and starts falsely accusing her and denying her a trial. That's how I consider bullying. You know, I'm gonna tell you something, and you can't say I'm wrong, right? And looks at the bully and says, okay, so I'm gonna get back. Can I get back to you tomorrow? Because I'm gonna call my Aunt Jeannie, and she's gonna tell me exactly how I can respond to you. And so email, and she says, Aunt Jeannie, okay, so here's the situation. And then she says, okay, so I don't really know what's going on. Can you just call me back and tell me what I can do to fix it?
Wow.
So a couple of things. She says the particulars of this situation are irrelevant. She is not going to be fooled into what I call talking about the square footage, okay? But what's the real thing going on? How can I love this guy? So I told her, and he was basically, as silly as these things are, it was about he was telling her that she pronounced a word incorrectly. So she went back to him and said, well, you know, I actually like how you pronounce it. I just happen to prefer pronouncing it this way, a different way. But I really like how you, imagine this. He's telling her that she does it wrong, and she's saying, well, I actually like the way you do it. I just happen to have this preference. I mean, that's like a non sequitur, right? Well, then the bully says to her, well, you know what? I kind of like the way you do it, too. In fact, I'm going to start doing it. So she doesn't even tell me what happens. And it's a couple months later, and I say, you know, Ellie, what happened to that? She goes, oh, I don't have to tell you about it because it's all fixed. That's another brilliant observation, right? That we're really only attentive to things that we are in pursuit of participating into achieving what I call a status quo upgrade. Right? If I've already done it, I'm on to the next thing that is calling my loving participation. Right? So then I say to her, well, I actually would love to hear the story because it might be a good one to tell people and they could learn this from you. She goes, oh, okay, if it's helping to you and you want to do it, then it's a good reason for me to tell you about it. So then she continues the story and says what he says to her, and she's not done yet. So she ends it with, he did that. He said that. He liked how I did it. He did that to make me feel good, and he did. So he gets right back to how he was affected. And I might have not made this as clear, is that we can kind of talk from our heads or we can talk from our hearts after we've digested it. And it's the difference between, you know, saying the dessert was very good or I enjoyed it very much.
Jeannie, what about the kind of bully that, you know, maybe getting a little bit older than second grade, maybe fourth or fifth grade, who actually might physically threaten kids on the playground? You know, and there's a situation where the child might be feeling frightened.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a way that, you know, in your approach that the child can deal with this?
You know, I really believe that we need to enlist and invite the help of other people, right? When I am most afraid, I get to go even to a senior teacher, right, or principal and say, here's my situation. And instead of saying, that guy is doing something wrong, the child can say, I am actually afraid to be around this person, and this is what, this is why. Right? So instead of saying, you know, the dessert was terrible, I would say, I would really like it if the dessert could be different, or this is how the dessert affects me, you know, and substitute bully for that dessert, right? So in what that will do, the magic will take place. You will convert that principle into approaching extremely differently the situation and pulling out her own effective response to it. So it's kind of the same it's the same spirit or the same approach. But the first thing to do is to who is the person that I want to play a game of catch with? I feel afraid to play this game of catch with the bully, as my niece did when she was in second grade. Okay, she converted a game of throw at to a game of catch with that maneuver, right? Similarly, when I was in the investment bank, I was playing the game of throw at. I'm the one who called the game, but then I changed the game to a game of catch with once I decided to put out my receptive, you know, inquiring, ask even one interruptive question like that. But in this case, it would be who do I believe really can help me? And I don't want them I don't want to tell them what to do. I want to share with them, here is my situation. Oh, there are lots of words I like to use too. Preeta, I forgot to tell you. I start with, here is my situation. Or I find that I no longer want to play on the playground, and I would like you to help me figure out how I can do it. And
So that person isn't necessarily interacting with the bully, but they'll interact with someone, and maybe eventually they can interact with the bully.
And it could be likely that the bully has to be loved more, right?
Yeah.
And that the bully shouldn't be punished, but they're acting out as a bully for an underlying other reason. And you get very fast to that other underlying reason, you cure it, and then the situation instantly changes.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, thank you. This is from Jyoti in Mountain View. And Jyoti writes, good to hear you, Jeannie, as always. I find myself shutting down and withdrawing as a way to cope whenever I am treated like a flower girl when I believe I have been a lady, going back to the early the early metaphor. Any practical suggestions on how to find the courage to be more open to taking what feels like abuse?
Jyoti is... Hi, Jyoti. She's one of my longtime friends. I still remember my first meeting with you. And you remember when I said that some of the most discriminated people on planet Earth are smart women? Very often, and we're taught as women to do exactly what Jyoti, you were saying, you know, retreat in. I can't think my way out of this. I can't convince my head that... of anything, because it's already co-opted in this embedded social bias. And I've already developed almost a reflex to do exactly as you so beautifully stated, retreat into yourself. And what I need to do in that situation, I believe, is to go right up to the person, almost as though you're having this out-of-body experience and you're observing your own self. Asking the question of the observer or of the person who is treating you like a flower girl and saying, can you help me understand why I feel this way? Or can you help me understand why I think you're dismissing this problem? And I have to ask it a real question. I think this is a very powerful intervention. It turns out that courage follows that. That's what's going to create my courage. So asking a question about something that I really want to know, my curiosity, will create the courage to then help me have this receptive conversation. But I've got to go first. And, you know, it reminds me of the movie with Dustin Hoffman, Rain Man. And, you know, he was not very liked by people. And there's this one poignant scene that's very short. And he just looks at his brother and he says, "Why don't they like me?" At that very moment, you fell in love with the guy. And it doesn't matter if you hated him a lot or just a little bit or even liked him. It's one step. You parachute into great love. And it doesn't matter where you start. You're always one step away. And so when I was teaching in business schools, I remember one of my students in this very arrogant setting initially said, "Well, you know, Jeannie, you have to get us to like you." And I was trying to really employ these tenets that I had learned about receiving theory that I had developed. And one of them is that my relationship to others is very separate from your relationship to me. So I looked at my MBA students and I said, "You know, it doesn't concern me if you like me. However, I care an enormous amount that I like you. How can you help me?" And it's almost like I became beloved in that instant. It was an instant shift. And I wasn't asking them to change. I was being affected by what they said, reminding me of something that I truly wanted, and expressing that to them. And that it was like a magic that happened.
Yeah. So how, going back to Jody's questions, how do you find the courage to do that? When somebody's speaking disrespectfully to me, I want to strike back at them and put them down. How do I find the courage to respond in a different way? What do you do inside yourself?
So I basically adopt a mantra. When I was at Stanford, I was walking around, and the mantra I shared earlier was respect everybody, no exceptions. So I would have to apply it to that very person. I would have to respect them. So I would shift my inner focus. I wasn't going to say, I still had these negative thoughts and beliefs about this person. I'm not saying get rid of those. I'm saying shift, stop looking in that direction, and just shift a little bit over and start looking for ways in which you could hear them. A kind of a rule of thumb is, if I want to be heard, then let me figure out how I can hear, demonstrate hearing. If I want to, you know, be loved, let me figure out how I can love right now. So I'm using what I'm lacking as a guide to say, oh, let me be exactly that. I notice you over there. It's like I'm pointing my finger at somebody. You are judging me. Then instead I'm going to shift my focus from my index finger that's pointing at that problem, and I'm going to shift to the three fingers that are actually pointing in my direction. And I'm going to physically shift. And I think I might have to hold my hand under the desk with my finger pointing out and even look at my hand and physically look, take my eyes from my index finger to my middle ring and pinky finger that's looking at me, to give myself permission. So it's really giving myself permission, not courage. I need a permission slip, and I have two permission slips in my pocket. One to invite me to truly participate in a learning-oriented way, and one to invite you to participate in a learning way.
That's very helpful, actually. Okay, here's the next question. I recently reached out to my adult birth daughter, who is now 21. It's an open adoption, but contact cooled after the first 10 years. I wrote a letter over many years, trying very hard to be careful about how I worded it. I wanted to open dialogue. I got back a letter with lots of opportunities to learn, let's put it that way. I love your prayer. Help me know what people need. That's what I need to do here. I'd love your input. Thank you for this beautiful call.
Wow, you made me cry. This is, it doesn't get more important than this, the situation that you're in. And I often think that when we are given these very, very challenging situations, we are being trained by God to become this amazing role model. It's only if I encounter, it's a compliment to have such challenging situations that you have a deep want. And so here's what's happening, I believe, is that I have to have my want be bigger than my fear. And I can't, and in many cases, my fear is so enormous, and I really can't diminish my fear. It just is. And when you say that you are being very careful, I often when we're very careful or polite, we're often preoccupied with diminishing barriers instead of asking for what I truly want. So to first do, okay, say I truly would like it if I could have a relationship with you. Let me tell you what I truly want. And your carefulness concern is going to go away because there's nothing more powerful than sharing, even in a written word, what it is that you truly want. And what I would love to do if I could, here's how I think that I might be able to offer this answer in the best way, is if you would be willing to share with me your letter. What I often do is to offer a version 2 of it, and I can certainly send you examples of version 1, version 2, version 1, version 2. Version 1 comes from my head usually. Version 2 is purely coming from my heart. And the content is much better, much deeper, and it's irresistible. It's irresistible. So you can unlock fear by going first as you express what you truly want instead of try to convince the other person that they should do this. And I hope that makes a little bit of sense, but I would like to offer you and anyone else my email. Maybe we can provide that on the website. And if you would like to send me a version of a letter or an email that you were hoping to send to somebody, I would be happy to think with you on it of how to make it message of receptivity most clear. You understand it is for me to do it, and that's what I would like everybody who's interested to have a personal example, just like my little niece did, of, and she often thinks about that. Oh yeah, you coached me into behaving it for myself, and that's when I began to understand it.
Beautiful, and thank you for that. I'm sure there are people who will want to take you up on that. Okay, our next call here is from Maya in Maryland. And her question is, what are some effective techniques to relay to people that you are ready to receive? How do you signal that you're ready to receive?
And I love the word, Maya, thank you for your question. What a wonderful question. It's but inherent in your question, here's a really little bit of a catch-22 situation. I'm not trying to convince them of anything, including my interest in being receptive. Because it turns out that very thought gets me out of being receptive. I know this is extremely subtle. So I must focus on techniques that make me want to love you more, rather than techniques on getting you to think or know something about me. In other words, I have to be what I call modifiable instead of trying to prove I'm modifiable. So to answer the question in that way, I will say things like, you know, if somebody's being interrupted, this happened in my business school career, there's a guy a couple seats away from me who wasn't very popular, I think, and at the time he was asked to speak, and everybody started talking over him, including the professor. And I just leaned forward, and I looked at him, called him by name, you know, past a couple of people, and I looked at him, called him by name, and said, you know, I would like to hear what you have to say. Will you please continue? And that fueled him. And he started talking in a commanding way. Everybody was silenced, right? And I didn't think anything of it until 10 years after that. I was running on an airplane. I was sitting in the back, and there's this guy who kind of tricked me. He was in business class. And it was this man, this guy, my classmate I hadn't seen in 10 years. And he goes, Jeannie, I don't even remember the class. I don't remember the comment, but I remember how you made me feel. He talked the flight attendant into upgrading me to sit next to him. He telling the flight attendant, I have to tell this woman something that I've been thinking about every day and using every day. And he tells me that the trajectory of his life was different because of that. So it's a small act of kindness. Much like Mother Teresa would say, do small acts with great love. And I often like to tell myself, love will not get me there. Only great love will. Which means that I have to, the only people I have to love are those people that really are not loving toward me. You know, everybody else, they can handle it on their own. They're not going to, it's almost like I'm doing triage for the world, right? If you just have a cut, that will heal on its own. You can find your own Band-Aid. But, you know, it's the people who are the most unloving, who are the most in need of my loving them.
Beautiful. And speaking of love, here's a note from Mish in New York. And she says, on the subject of receiving, so it comes down to faith, faith that what you ask for or need in a situation will happen or come to you. And then she says in quotes, I aspire to be a giver of love, and giver of strength.
Beautiful, beautiful. And, you know, I might add, thank you, Mish, for that. I might add, it's not just what I get. It changes what I want. So sometimes when I, if I truly ask, so if I truly invite somebody to come to my party, and I know that I'll say something instead of, you should come to my party, I won't say that. I would say, will you come to my party? My party won't be the same without you, right? It's a pure invitation, and I know I did my best for the world, right? And they don't come, I'm actually okay that they're not coming because they have something better to do, and I want them to do that. In fact, when I would teach courses in business programs, I would say, if you have a better place to be, a more useful place for you than my classroom, then I want to hold it. I don't want you to stay here. I benefit from your using your time the most wisely. And so it kind of broadens my way of looking at the world. So it's, I ask for things. So, for example, I'll ask to be upgraded on an airplane, but all the seats are taken.
Mm.
I get the goodwill, and the person at the gate says, I really wanted you on it. Here's my cell phone number. The next time you come through here, call me because I really want to do my best. Almost as, and I was so satisfied.
Thank you. Okay, so here's the last question in the queue, and then we've got one or two more after that. So this is from Anuj, and Anuj says, related to listening, what are some practices that help you become aware and focus on listening deeply in a business setting so you can speak to that when the time comes, not from your own agenda or the situational agenda that was created?
Okay.
How do you do this in a business setting?
Well, you know, I remember coaching one of my executives that who was, by the way, very often when you're in a in an executive situation, we have the rules and the performance evaluations that I'm given credit for what I do and give and how smart I am, right? But not so much on how much I learned from other people. But so I have this little trick that I often do. I have a little corner. I have a piece of paper that I'm taking my notes on, and I make a little a square in the upper right-hand column. So I have an empty little square, like 2 inches by 3 inches by 3 inches, on my piece of paper. And what I do is I try to say, I need to put stuff in there that I learned from this meeting that I didn't even know I didn't know.
Mm.
So that I have to, and so very often I'm coaching somebody. I said, you know what? Here's what I'm ready to receive. I'm ready to learn what you got out of that meeting that you didn't know before. So we often go in, and Prita mentioned this confirmation bias, that it's very highly likely that I'm going to see what I expected to see, and I'm even going to create it into being. But what if I had the added goal, and I'm using goal, not just agenda, but goal, to look for something that I didn't expect? That's going to, even if I don't write anything in that, it's going to change how I listen. It's going to change how I talk, and I'm going to unknowingly, unbeknownst to myself, I'm going to be going first. I'm going to shift myself into this receptive state of being, not because I'm cognitively trying to prove it, but because I have a want. I have to learn something from you that I didn't even know you were going to tell me, and that seems to be a sufficient initiating move. That's just one idea.
Great. Thank you. So I'd like to go to Prita for any final thoughts that she has, and then after that I have a final question, and then we'll move to our closing. Prita, you're on.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Well, Jeannie, this has been so rich and so beautiful.
Just one quick, we in the service-based community like to talk a lot about inner transformation, and of course your entire theory is about that, about how can I change myself or change the way in which I'm perceiving a situation to shift the energy.
Yes.
I guess the question I have is, as you've done your research, and we started off saying with your foundational story, this is the way you've interacted with people, and then you did the research to kind of try and bring that to light and life for other people. But how has your research changed you, if at all?
Oh, you know, I even wrote, I was rereading my dissertation when you had asked me for it, and I remember at the last of my acknowledgement said, you know, this research has changed me. You know, I think that I see with different eyes, and I give myself permission more to go first. Because one of the things that I realized is that people are doing the best they can. It's very hard. It's very easy for me to understand where I can't know something. I can't know what you want, but I forget that the other person is in the very same predicament that I'm in. And I guess the biggest aha for me was that the other person is in the very same predicament that I am and probably has very similar needs in this interaction than I do. And so I use my inner voice to, and this is the last story, I think, and we talked, I hope this is a good way to end. This is where it becomes most important for me. I was, this story I remember very often, and it's, I was just TAing an accounting course in the industrial engineering department at Stanford in 1994, the fall of 1994. Or no, 95, sorry, 95, 1995. And I was giving a one of two review sessions for this accounting midterm that was about ready to come up. And if you can imagine, all the kids were, all the undergraduates were huddled around, squeezed into this small room. Everyone asked a question, except for one individual in the back of the room. It was a woman, a minority woman, right? And I remember my head was saying, you know, it's a review session, it's her job to ask a question. If she doesn't have a question, then fine. And I kept, my heart said, well, maybe it's hard for her to ask a question. It's my job, because if I'm in the know, it is my go. So here I was, and it was an internal discussion I was having between my own head and my own heart. And my head was saying, you shouldn't do it. And my heart was saying, you must do it, right? Well, I let my head win for a couple minutes. And I realized I wasn't feeling very well. I was looking at how I was affected by that. And I just looked up and I said to her, you know, I don't even know your name, but I noticed this, that everyone else is now on round two or three of their questions, and I would like to know if you have a question. It turned out she didn't have a question, but at the very end, she said, I was very happy to be learning from whatever everybody else was doing. I didn't know this, but she was one of the top performers in the school. In the class, she had gotten all 100% on all of her homework. But she came back at the end of that review session and thanked me for inviting her question. So it didn't even matter if she had one. The fact that I invited it made a huge difference. Because in my head, one of the best argument I had in my head was, I'm doing another session in 2 days. She can come to that session and ask her questions. Well, it turned out that very night, after the very first session, there was a road trip from Stanford to Berkeley with about 8 people in a van, and the van encountered a truck that had shifted lanes. And to avoid a head-on collision, the driver of the van went off the road and into this ravine. And there was one casualty on that van, and that casualty was that student, who I thought I would see 2 days later. So the enormous gratitude I had for listening to my heart, it has changed how I think about interpersonal interactions. And if I am in the know, it truly is my go. And I can get on that side of the interaction in which I can be the inviter. If I'm the boss, I can ask my subordinates, oh, you know what, I would like to know if you have any ideas. Or if I'm the subordinate, I could say, you know, would it be okay if I shared with you some of my thoughts? So it doesn't matter which side of that interaction is on. If I'm in the know, it's my go to be invitational.
Beautiful. Thank you. So we're at the end of our time for the call. Jeannie, I want to thank you again. I think it's clear from
the questions people have been asking, and certainly from all of us listening to you, just how moving this has been, and your message, which on the one hand is so simple, and yet on the other hand not so simple, and so transformative. So thank you so much. We traditionally end these calls with a final question. So here's my final question to you. How can we as a service space community support you in your work?
What a beautiful offer. Do you know, I feel as though that I'm just one member of this team, this receiving team, and I'd be so honored if everyone who has an inkling of an interest in this could join this team of helping to shape this message so that it can, my goal is to have stories of people, I would use the word courageous enough to say, you know what, I have this version one that I'm doing, and maybe I'll just email Jeannie, see if I can approach it in a version two kind of way, so that I can provide an example that I can offer as a contrasting example that might help somebody else into the future. And I'm very interested in creating a platform that we can all encourage each other by our own attempts to decide to be receptive. And it's really an attempt. All I have to do is decide that I want to try it, and that gets me there. And I would be so honored if I could have a way of keeping in touch with those who are interested and engaging in an interaction and a discussion. That I'm thinking that there might even be someone out there who might be able to talk with me and others about even creating a space on the web that we can have a joint meeting space on the web that we can actually enter into a conversation about this with examples and questions that I would be happy to answer for the benefit of anybody else who's reading it, you know. So email would be a great start. Please email me. I'd be so delighted to hear from you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.